Thank you, Melanie. Sorry about the liturgical dance that you got to watch me do up here, trying to fix this microphone. Never fails to happen at the wrong time. There's a whole bunch of stories in our texts that we just don't know. And I'm guessing that this might be one of them. I'll confess that it was one of those of, oh yeah, this. And that's where that comes from when I read it myself. And it's not because we don't think it important or that we don't read the text as it is, but simply because so many of these stories can and do get lost. And they can sound a little bit extraordinary. But this is indeed extraordinary. It is a story, yes, of war. But it is a story of how God fights, not to win, but to build true peace. This is from 2 Kings, in chapter 6, verses 8 through 23. Once, when the king of Aram was at war with Israel, he took counsel with his officers. He said, at such and such a place will be my camp. But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, take care not to pass this place because the Arameans are going to be there. The king of Israel sent word to the place of which the man of God spoke, and more than once or twice he warned such a place so that it was on the alert. The mind of the king of Aram was greatly perturbed because of this. He called his officers and said to them, now tell me who among you sides with the king of Israel? Then one of his officers said, not one, my lord. It is Elisha, prophet in Israel, who tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedchamber. He said, go and find where he is. I shall send and seize him. He was told, he's in Dothan. So he sent horses and chariots there in a great army. They came by night and surrounded the city. When the attendant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. His servant said, alas, master, what shall we do? Elisha replied, do not be afraid, for there is more of us than there are of them. Then Elisha prayed, O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see. So the Lord opened the eyes of the servant, and he saw that the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. When the Arameans came down against him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, strike this people, please, with blindness. So he struck with blindness as Elisha had asked. Elisha said to them, this is not the way, this is not the city, follow me, and I'll bring you to the man that you seek. And he led them to Samaria. As soon as they entered Samaria, Elisha said, O Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see. The Lord opened their eyes, and they saw that they were inside Samaria. When the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, Father, shall I kill them? Shall I kill them? Elisha answered, no. Did you catch them with your sword and your bow, those who you want to kill? Set food and water before them so that they may eat and drink, and let them go to their master. So he prepared for them a great feast. After they ate and drank, he sent them on their way, and they went to their master. And the Arameans no longer came raiding into the land of Israel. Was I right? Did you know this story? Did you know all of it? I'm guessing maybe you heard the first part, but maybe not the second, more commonly. I have to confess, I do like a good piece of military history. Let's be clear, I am committed to non-resistance and peace as the way of life and the way of faith, clearly and fully. And my understanding of the way of the kingdom of the enemies holds sway well beyond the call of duty and the ingenuity of military ventures. But that doesn't mean that I don't respect and am fascinated by what has been done in these ventures in these ways. I remember being transfixed by the Ken Burns documentary, The Civil War, screening out to the fuzz of a late 80s antenna TV, seeing it for the first time as it blended human story and structural tragedy. I've gone to Gettysburg and walked the fields of Pennsylvania and wondered at the bigness of it all, in all of the history and the sacrifice, saddened all the time by the waste of warfare, no matter the age, the time, or the cause. Maybe it's just fundamentally a guy thing, but there's a lot to respect in the work of soldiering in every generation. Even if you don't necessarily think that the way of soldiering is the way of peace. Even wishing that the occupation could in time be fully and finally retired. There's much to learn and honor in knowing the history of our wars, the heroic and the painful, even as somebody who is living another way. But yet, somehow in the long list of military engagements that get studied, I'm guessing this story of ours this morning doesn't make many technical and tactical manuals in the very various colleges where they study such things. So what you do when you have an enemy who's raiding you in the middle of the night is you wait for the chariots of fire to come. And then when you capture them, you sit them down and you feed them and send them home. There you go. Surefire victory. And I'm guessing that, like I said, it's a story that we probably haven't spent a whole lot of time for. It's understandable. And these long histories of the Kings and Chronicles is where many a good Bible reading of the year program goes to die for want of discipline. At least that's the case for me. Just for a quick reminder here, 2 Kings is the history of the kings after the time of David and his direct descendants, with the demands of power and principle to lead the nation of Israel into every possible conundrum and eventually into Babylonian exile. The warning that was given to the people when they first said, "We want a king like everybody else," was coming true with a vengeance. you do know that the kings are just going to play with power and play with war and taxes and time again. Why not just stay with the divine? And here, the politics of God is placed up and against the politics of how things are. And most of the time, the powers that be ignore the prophets on a good day. And on a bad day, kill them just to get them to be quiet. But the results are fairly predictable. But also we have to say that another reason why this story doesn't make a huge amount of sense is it doesn't make sense. It doesn't connect with our world as we know it. It's really common for me to go out and say, okay, what other commentators are, what do they have to say about this? What's out there? And almost exclusively, the line for the story is, well, God, like at the time of Elijah, surrounds us to make us impenetrable and strong. And very seldom do they tag on the ending part where both sides of the equation didn't quite have the formula right. The Arameans didn't quite have it right to say, we can just waltz in there and do what we want. And the king of Israel didn't have it right when he said, aha, now I have them and I can kill them. And the way that God fights is not the way of our world. Invisible chariots of fire and horses, the tanks and super weapons of ancient warfare, are not tenable assets when planning for battle. We might take this as a moralistic tale, but is this really how God does war? And what's more, what does it have to do with us and our world, real or not? Let me answer the second question first. I don't think that this is an academic exercise or question of moving companies or battalions around a board like so many toy soldiers to see what if. But I think there is applicability in our lives. We deal with issues like this all the time. Certainly not with weapons and wars, but certainly with conflict. We have histories and conflicts that have festered long and gone sour. We have enemies that we struggle to like, let alone loving them. Or we cannot and should not even begin to entertain the fundamental narcissism that would assume that our enemies and God's enemies are one and the same, or that God fights for his faithful unreservedly with overwhelming force. As we must all entertain the somewhat disturbing thought now and again that God is not automatically on our side, whatever side that might be. We must take notes on how God fights in with the goal of emulating how we then are to follow. This brings us back to our first question, and it is, yes, it is how God fights. Fighting for true peace and to call the kingdom into being time and again. This is not a battle of the tit-for-tat revengers that make the whole world blind, or simply the we will take our revenge in our due time. Claims that we have even heard uttered this very week. But rather, a way of winning the battle that is far beyond just finding who is more powerful. And it's hard to see that. It's hard to know that because we're so accustomed to, you don't set out a feast for your enemies. You don't, certainly not when you have them look good and proper. This isn't what happens. This isn't what's real. This isn't how the world works. It's right there in the name. Watch a reality show sometime, people. The whole point of reality shows is to say, well, the reality is if you want to win the prize, you find the best way to manipulate and connive and have alliances, at least as long as they serve you, until you can find the way to win the ultimate and final goal. And here comes God saying, that's not reality. That's not what's real. This is the work of reconciliation, the work that my kingdom is far beyond anything that you can imagine. The work of forgiveness, that's what's real. And that's what's other. We live in a world where the only good enemy is a dead enemy. Fill in the blank there with the undesirable of the day, and you have just made it in the bumper sticker business. We're given this because of the world as it is, because we want the them to be other than us. And we're given so many thems because, and others, so we can be opposed to them, because it gives the people who's calling people other in the first place more power. There's a lot of power in fear and anger and hatred. And they offer it by the scoopful. And we need to be able to say, no, that's not real. There is no other. There is only us. But that takes a lot of special vision. The truth is that we, like Elijah's servant, see things as we are accustomed to seeing them. It's one of the fundamental temptations of the garden. Eat the fruit that you might see as God sees. It's right there in Genesis 3. Eyes were opened with the fundamental temptation, but they're opened to the wonders of sin and brokenness. But close to the grace and presence of God. Accordingly, we need spiritual glasses to correct this fundamental error. Throughout history, Yahweh God comes alongside and portrays true reality for us. And God intervenes almost with regularity to show the bigger truth at work beyond the barriers that would hide it from us. Think of Hagar, of Moses, of Peter, of the Emmaus Road and the Damascus Road and the Transfiguration Mountain. Each one of those times, God comes and says, see, here's something new. And the people need time and space to see it. It'd be easy to say that this is just a story, like I say, of God being for God's people. And it's fairly straightforward. If you have a prophet problem, remove the prophet. Time and again in this world, God's world lies somewhere between the unseen and the unknown. The true power is not of these armaments and of force, but in the ways of the God who saves. The first eye-opener of the story is the real world to the real world of God is that God holds the victory, and not just the ones with the weapons. But like I also said, this reality check does not stop there. The second eye-opener is that the real world is that the world can never be governed by the cycle of revenge and violence, but only by grace and forgiveness. We see the chariots at first, and we're given to seeing that as the place of true peace. But the hard work of seeing and living God's reality is saying, no, you don't get to do this either. You need to take the risk of putting the meal before them and seeing what happens. We've grown so accustomed to the way things are, to the normalcy of our hurts and arguments and our petty but all too real realities, that we take it for granted that the only way that we can be in this world is carrying our hurts, carrying what is there, carrying our resentments with us. And whenever it's suggested that there could be something beyond this, that there could be the work of forgiveness, that there could be the work of doing something different, there's an instantaneous recoil as we rattle off all the reasons why that could never be and how it could never work. We rationalize why it can never happen that way because the work of forgiveness is truly scary. The work of setting a meal before you, having your vision corrected, knowing something different, asks you to take the risk of putting yourself out there, and you might get hurt. But yet it's something that we are invited into because it is the reality of God. The reality of freedom and the reality of forgiveness is the work of God and the presence of God. If we can only dare to do it. We need to see as God sees. And all too rarely we can get glimpses of the world breaking through. I've seen tables of forgiveness, and they were never easy. They were never simple, but they were worthwhile. And I've seen and I have heard realms of protection, figurative and very real. If you want a devotional that will last for you for a lifetime, go and spend time with the church in the Southern Hemisphere sometime. It only takes a couple of weeks, but you will learn something along the way. I'll never forget the time of sitting with brothers and sisters of the church who said, well, you know how I found this church? I was a member of the paramilitaries in Colombia, and I was set to observe and to invade and to destroy this church. But I could never do it because of all the guards outside. To which they always say, but there never was any guards. There never were people standing watch. there never was, that only what they saw was God's protection. And in time, they saw through that and were invited in. And those who came to destroy are now part of the body and now part of the work. And yes, it's fantastic. Yes, it's over the top. Yes, it's hard to believe. But isn't it good? Isn't it amazing? Isn't it hopeful to consider that there might be something other beyond what we expect from day to day? That's something that we can hold on to. God's reality is the real world, the world of forgiveness. It starts simple. A cup of coffee, a brave conversation, some hard listening, some risky living, that there's love above all else. And it grows from there. Not by your or my tactical prowess, but by because it is the will of God. This is how we seek peace and build God's way in our midst beyond our very expectations. May we embrace God's reality and God's way, trusting that the world of forgiveness, the world of hope, the world of peace is the world as it is and as it will be. And may we see God's hand in power and in weakness and see it where it truly is. Amen.